I have to tell you, over the last 2 years, Karen and I have spent a lot of time reflecting and praying about everything in this country's dealing with and what we might do to serve. And I don't have anything to announce today, but I can tell you, when I got time to announce, come this Wednesday, I'm announcing in Iowa.
Former Vice President Mike Pence at a Republican fundraiser in Iowa over the weekend, and so he will announce formally tomorrow. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie beat him by a day. He announced today. And over on the Democratic side, and yes, there is technically a Democratic side, even though incumbent President Joe Biden is running for re-election, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., anti-vaccine conspiracy theorist and son of America's most famous political family, is in the race. And according to a CNN poll, he has 20% support among Democratic and Democratic-leaning voters. We're going to talk about all this now with Michael Shearer, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
All right. Well, let's talk about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. You had a big profile of him this week. And yesterday he spoke with Elon Musk on Twitter Spaces for some 2 hours, which, like, you know, I guess they talked about all sorts of things. What were the highlights? I don't know if you listened in on that.
I did listen. And I mean, when Robert Kennedy speaks, he speaks generally about the same sets of topics. So he covered a lot of the issues he's been talking about as he travels the country. That the central theme of his campaign is that people in power in the United States have been lying to the American people, and as a result, unfairly treating the middle class and enriching themselves for decades, and he's the guy who's going to set that right. And he makes that argument on a number of different planes. He argues that pharmaceutical companies have captured regulatory agencies, you know, oil companies have captured regulatory agencies. He argues that national defense hawks have captured foreign policy and are getting us into wars we don't need to be in, that technology companies are censoring Americans during COVID, and that has to be stopped. And he's the truth teller who's going to set it right.
Okay, so all of that doesn't sound terribly unusual for a candidate, what you just said. But then he does veer into some unusual areas, to put it mildly. He claims that antidepressants like Prozac are responsible for gun violence.
He said he wants to study whether that's a fact. It's a hypothesis. But yeah, when it comes to the topic of pharmaceutical drugs, he is pretty far outside the mainstream of science. He's argued that the COVID vaccine has killed more people than it saved, despite abundant science showing the opposite. He's argued that mercury in vaccines is a major driver of childhood neurodegenerative disorders like autism, even though there's abundant science as well that studied that issue and concluded that is not the case. You know, the most of the mercury was taken out of vaccines about 20 years ago. But his case is that there are a number of these sorts of conspiracies to trick the American people. And he's actually running in an interesting way. He's running as a Democrat, using his family name, his family's history in the party. But he's also trying very deliberately to appeal outside the party. For instance, you know, he was asked about the Second Amendment yesterday, and when I talked to him as well, he will not commit to further gun regulation, which is rather unusual for a Democrat. He basically says we need consensus on the issue, and he wants to look for, you know, other ways of dealing it, or, you know, bridging the divide. He wants to stop funding the war in Ukraine. He says he would bring a peace there, which is also against President Biden's approach. He's argued that the 2004 election with John Kerry and George W. Bush was stolen by George W. Bush. And he said that he's not sure, but believes that Biden won the 2020 election.
Interesting. And he wants to close the border. So let me play a clip of tape from this Twitter Spaces conversation yesterday.
You know, above all, we need to seal the border. I'm actually going to the border tonight. I'm crossing the border, I think, around 3 o'clock in the morning into Mexico, and I'll be talking with people on both sides of the border and talking to stakeholders. And over the next 3 days, be meeting with people from the Border Patrol and elsewhere to try to formulate policies that will seal the border permanently.
Well, before we talk about the substance of what he said, what has happened to his voice?
So in his 40s, he came down with an unexplained muscular condition of his vocal cords that causes that raspy voice. He doesn't know what caused it. He suspects, actually, and this is part of the theme that it may have been a side effect of a flu vaccine he took, but he doesn't know for sure. And it can be, at least initially, a little disruptive, although I've seen him speak now in a number of places, and after a while you kind of get used to it, but it is an unusual profile for a presidential candidate.
Yeah. So he wants to seal the border permanently, and then taking what you said about guns and some of the other things he said about vaccines, and he just sounds more like a typical MAGA Republican than a Democrat.
Well, I think it's a blend of both. I mean, he supports Social Security and Medicare. I think he follows his family's view of the role of government and helping the middle class. I don't know what that means that he wants to seal the border. He hasn't given specifics. I mean, certainly there are Democrats who support strong border security. I don't know whether that means, he's also wants to change the rules for refugees seeking asylum into the country, and he has yet to be clear on that. But he said that, I mean, his path to winning, he believes, is not just winning over a number of people who now support former President Trump, so that MAGA base, but also getting them to vote in Democratic primaries. I don't think he believes that if the sort of typical Democratic voters turn out in these primaries, and a lot of them are open primaries, you can just register the day of, that he has a path to winning. He's trying to attract people into the Democratic Party who are not here right now. And in that way, it's a similar sort of approach to what President Trump took in 2015 and 2016 when he was sort of remaking, what it meant to be a Republican.
So that CNN poll, the 20%, is that based on his policies or is it mainly name recognition? The Kennedy name. Yes, I like it.
Yeah, we don't know for sure, but I think it's safe to assume a big part of that is name recognition at this point. There was a candidate in 2017 named Robert Kennedy Jr., absolutely no relation, who ran for Senate in Alabama and initially was winning the polls there just because of the name. No one knew anything about who he was. He ended up losing that election very badly. But we know that there is definitely an appeal there to the Kennedy name. In that same CNN poll, it found about 44% of Democrats who did not currently support Kennedy were willing to consider him. And then when asked what their top reason for considering him, the strongest answer was just the name, the family tradition. So I think there's a huge appeal there. And it's entirely an open question, what kind of backlash he'll face once the Democrats understand that his approach to politics is a little more outside the box than both his uncle and his father's.
Mm-hmm. So far, the Biden campaign is not particularly concerned?
Well, they're definitely not saying anything. I think their calculation is that to engage with him right now would only elevate him. That they're working closely with the Democratic National Committee. They've said there's not going to be any primary debates. They're basically unanimity among elected Democrats right now, at least publicly, in support for Biden. And they are very aware that in the past, when you have contested primaries for a president seeking re-election, it tends to hurt them down the stretch in a general election. So they're hoping to avoid that.
Mm. Okay, turning to the ever-crowded or increasingly crowded GOP field, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu said he's not going to run because he says a crowded field helps Trump. He's come out as an anti-Trumper, except that he said he would vote for the party's nominee, the most popular Republican, which at this point is Donald Trump. But aside from that, given the fact that we have Chris Christie in the race now and Mike Pence will be in the race as of tomorrow, what does this do to the political field on the GOP side?
I think what it means is we're almost set in who's running and where they are at the starting gate. It's been a few months now of people sort of slowly getting in or pretending they're going to get in or talking about getting in. But at the end of this week, we'll basically have a set field. I think the way to think about it right now is that two candidates dominate 75% of the primary support in the early polls, which are not dispositive. They change very often in the course of a campaign. Trump's got about 50. DeSantis, the Florida governor, has about 25. And then you have a bunch of other candidates polling in the low, mid-single digits. Mike Pence, the former vice president, Vivek Ramaswamy, who's a businessman who's gotten some traction recently. And then two South Carolina natives, Tim Scott, the senator, and Nikki Haley, the former governor. And then below that, you have a whole other group that are just trying to get above 1% in some polls, or up to 1%, including Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, Chris Christie. it's a pretty big field. Trump has made very clear that he's very happy with it being a big field. He keeps saying complimentary things about all the others. And the reason is that as long as there's opposition to him is divided, he's in a pretty strong position. And that was what the governor of New Hampshire was referring to yesterday when he said he wasn't going to run. He said he is going to endorse. He's going to try and pressure the other candidates to winnow the field later this year if they don't have a clear path to victory. And so that's sort of the dynamic we have right now.
All right, Michael, always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's Michael Scherer, national political reporter for The Washington Post. All right, it is the final stretch of our SOS pledge drive, our Save Our Summer pledge drive. If you haven't heard, in case you haven't tuned in, we are mounting an emergency summer fundraiser because, well, our books are a little lower than we would like them to be, a lot lower, in fact. It's been a tough time out there in the media world, and public radio is no exception because, well, everything's tough these days. And you've heard of inflation. Inflation is hitting us as well. So if you have it in you to make an extra special donation to KCRW to keep us here and alive and our lights on and our summer buzzing, please do so now at kcrw.com/join. Or if you are not a member, please join now. Now is the perfect time to become a member. And if you do become a monthly sustaining member, and we do love our monthly sustaining members the most, and we love all our children, but we love the monthly ones the most because we can count on you every month and we know exactly how much revenue we have coming in, you will unlock an extra $300. So whatever you donate at the monthly level, you're going to give us an extra $300, and that is thanks to KCRW champion Murat Sehidoglu. So thank you, Murat, and thank you for donating whatever amount you can to Save Our Summer and become a monthly donor to this public radio station, which is unique amongst all radio stations, I will say, on the planet. And we are lucky to live in Los Angeles and to have this radio station here. So do not take us for granted. KCRW.com/give and do it now because we are fast running out of time. We're going to end this fundraiser in just a couple of days. Okay, coming up, huge demand plus a threatened pilot strike. Yikes. What that means for summer travel, we'll tell you all about it next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you traveled by plane over Memorial Day weekend, you got a taste of what is in store this summer, and that is busy airports. This summer is expected to be even busier than last summer when there was chaos at some airports. Joining us now is Natalie Compton, travel reporter at The Washington Post. Hi.
Hi.
So, yikes, last summer.
Yes.
Is it going to be the same?
So one piece of comforting news was that we had a big test over Memorial Day weekend and nothing went wrong. We had airline passenger numbers that were higher than before the pandemic, and there were not major catastrophes that held up thousands of people. So that is a hopeful sign.
Yes. And so why is that? Are there just more pilots and flight attendants working this summer?
Airlines definitely saw the writing on the wall. They knew this onslaught of passengers were coming. They have ramped up their staffing. Industry insiders say there's still a lack of experience in a lot of those new hires. So it's not, okay, we hired more people and everything's going to be perfect. But they have definitely upped their staffing numbers. They have adjusted their schedules accordingly. So they're not too stretched thin. But we also got lucky with good weather. So there's always the chance that one freak storm could throw things off. We don't want to discount that. But mm-hmm. for now, it seems like airlines have made adjustments to better handle the crowds.
Well, did they buy more planes? Because I remember during the height of COVID, they were selling off some of their planes and they were laying off people thinking, well, this is it. We need to cut back.
We know that there aren't as many planes back in the air again. We know airlines are still buying planes and there are ones that were retired or sitting out in fields. So the number of planes is not back to where it was. But we know that airlines see the demand. They want to increase getting people into their seats as much as possible. So we'll see those continue to increase.
What about prices? What do they look like?
Unfortunately, prices are high. Everybody is saying that this is going to be an expensive summer for travel, whether you're looking at airline prices, hotel prices. What we can tell you is that if you haven't booked your summer travel or even looking ahead to holiday travel, set up price alerts so you can see if prices go up or if they dip. If you use something like Google Flights, you can see whether or not the fare that you're looking at is high or expected to drop a little. So you can be as smart about your purchase as possible and set up alerts to get a better deal.
Where is it the most expensive? Where are people wanting to go this summer?
So we know that it's going to be another summer of Italy. It's another big summer for Europe. Because airfare is up across the board, you're not likely to get a great deal going to popular parts of Europe during the summer. If you are trying to go to Asia, those flights are going to be more expensive than they were in the past. And anything over holiday weekends, super popular cities and mm-hmm. beach destinations, those are going to be high.
Yeah. Meanwhile, there is also the threat of a pilot strike, correct? Southwest and American, the pilots union there, both voted in favor of a strike. Not to say that they will go on strike, but they authorized.
Right. I think the key word is voted to authorize the strike. This is definitely a way to put pressure on the airlines to increase pilot pay. They're also looking for better scheduling. Since the pandemic happened, a lot of pilots had already been in negotiation over improving their contracts. They put all of that on hold to deal with this crisis. Now they're back working severe overtime hours. It's a really tough job. We've seen Delta come back and increase their salaries significantly. So American Southwest pilots are all looking for their airlines to do the same. Right now, there's no movement in the strike, but they're still in negotiation. So no threat of a walkout just yet.
But if they do walk out and you've already booked your flight, what happens? Do you get your money back?
If your flight is canceled by the airline, they are going to rebook you on something else. If that something else doesn't fit your schedule, you are entitled to a refund if you don't want to take that flight. They are hopefully not going to have this happen, and this shouldn't be a problem. But in the case that it is, I would definitely recommend people pay attention, have your airline's app downloaded on your phone so you're getting alerts about your flight, check your email, see what the airlines are saying via email to you, and keep an eye on backup options.
So the president said recently that he and the administration are going to write new regulations that will require airlines to compensate air travelers and cover their meals, their hotel rooms, if they are stranded for reasons within the airline's control. What does that mean?
Right now, there are no laws saying if an airline delays you or puts you in an uncomfortable situation that they have to get you a hotel or have to cover your meal vouchers. So the administration is trying to put together new rights for passengers. In the case that you are canceled on, the airlines should take care of you. We are definitely in a place where we're expecting the industry to fight back on this. So if an airline cancels on you or significantly delays your travel day, you should definitely ask them for things like a hotel voucher or a meal credit. Are they required to give it to you? No, but sometimes airlines do have goodwill and will try to help you out.
And what's going on with Southwest? I remember that craziness a few months ago in the wintertime when all those flights were canceled. Have they sorted all that out?
Southwest says they have sorted all of it out. They were highly embarrassed and paid extraordinary amounts of money to cover that embarrassment. Obviously, there are lots of people who will never fly again on Southwest. There are also a lot of people who swear by Southwest and say, even if I was held up for 28 hours at this airport, I'm still after those deals. So I think travelers are in good hands if they're flying Southwest in general. They were so embarrassed that they really don't want to let people down again.
Yeah. All right. So if you can avoid it, would you avoid it traveling this summer and maybe travel in the fall instead?
If you can, don't go to the Amalfi Coast or Lake Como in July. There are still so many people who
will. That's every year. Or Rome,
every
for that
year.
Matter.
And the people still end up there and go, what are all these other tourists doing here? And right. It was predictable. So even if you want to go to Italy this summer, there are other parts of Italy that you could go to that have less people there. So while I don't say don't travel this summer, I would say expect crowds at airports. You're going to want to pack food with you because the lines at airports are going to be heinous, whether you're getting coffee or trying to buy something at a Hudson News. So bringing a portable charger, bringing your own water bottle you can refill, stuff to make your travel day a little nicer. It's not going to be easy, but you should still have a very nice vacation.
Once you get
there. If you are patient, yeah.
Natalie Compton, travel reporter at the Washington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe you want to just pack your KCRW tote, your brand new tote bag, which is really, really cool. We have a brand new design. I urge you to go check it out at kcrw.com/give and pick it up for yourself for, you know, a pretty minor donation, all things considered. Speaking of all things considered, we do air that show later in the day. We air lots of NPR shows, but we also air lots of local programming that is created here. And it's not cheap to create local programming like Press Play, like Greater LA, which is coming up in half an hour from now, or all of the great cultural programs you hear, like The Treatment, The Business, Good Food, of course. All of these iconic programs come to you produced right here locally at KCRW. So, you know, this is an AI-generated content. This is locally curated and crafted. And I didn't even mention the fantastic music programming that we create here. So really, this is a unique situation we have going on here at KCRW. And we only do it with your support. We're having a little difficulty now in terms of our funding. It's just down, and for lots of reasons, I'm sure you're well aware, because you are a well-informed person. So we need to come to you in an emergency way to ask you to help us out here at kcrw.com/join. Go online, check out all of our fantastic thank you gifts. We also have some added incentives today. If you join as a monthly member, a sustaining member, we'll unlock a $300 extra donation from you. Actually, it's from one of our board members, but it will be yours in name only, and it will really help us out. So kcrw.com/join, do it today. And thank you. We cannot do it without you. Coming up, Patricia Arquette is getting really plum roles these days, including the role of Peggy in the new comedy High Desert.
And Peggy is chaos. And this world that she is in chaos. And maybe there's a part of that that is my playground.
We're going to have a really great conversation next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Actor Patricia Arquette has spent her entire adult life in front of the camera. She made her feature film debut when she was just 18 years old in the 1987 film A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. Since then, she's had critically acclaimed roles in movies such as True Romance, Flirting with Disaster, Ed Wood, and Boyhood. She won an Oscar for her role as the mother in that movie. She's also performed in numerous TV shows, including Medium, Severance, and her latest, which is called High Desert. That's a twisted comedy in which Arquette plays a manic former drug dealer who's trying to get her life together as she struggles to remain sober and cope with her mom's death. With her life in shambles, she decides to take on a new career as a private investigator.
Have you thought about what you're going to do next?
Regarding what?
Regarding what? I mean, look, it's fine that we supported you while mommy was here because you were taking care of her, but ain't happening anymore.
Hey, when I had money, we all had money.
From dealing drugs.
Okay, Judgy. It was a little pot. Maybe some hash. It was harmless.
There was cocaine.
Well, that was much later, and I did it. I didn't sell it.
Oh, wow.
And Patricia Arquette joins me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure. And over the years, lately especially, you have played some really meaty female characters. And I just want to list several of them, or a few of them. In The Act, you were a mom who was intentionally keeping her daughter sick and homebound. That's based on a true story. In the limited series Escape at Dannemora, your character is in a love triangle with two inmates. That's another true story. You starred in this TV series Medium, in which you play Allison Dubois, also based on a real person, and of course, your role in Boyhood. So I'm wondering, when you look at these women and these characters, and including the one you're playing now, Peggy, what is it about them and their complicated lives that you want to explore?
Well, part of it, I think, is that they are complicated. You know, mm-hmm. there was a time, especially early in my career, where I was the girlfriend, you know, largely, or the girl the boy wanted, or the bad girlfriend. But it was basically all around your desirability and the male's story, and you were supporting it. So all of these people are very interesting to me. And self-deception is a really interesting human quality to me. And to come to this time in my life where I'm getting these really interesting, complicated people is really fun. To go from Severance, which is very strict, a strict personality, a suppressed personality, a personality that's very interior, to this wild Tasmanian devil of a character that Peggy is, this giant mess that's constantly in motion and creating destruction everywhere she goes. It's just fun to play all these different things, and I'm just so lucky I get the chance.
And are these roles coming to you? Like, are people saying, I thought of you as the perfect actor for this role, or do you audition and compete for these roles?
I'm the worst auditioner, so please, please don't make me audition. Because I don't see it as finished work, and it's not really how I work. I work with another actor, and hopefully every take changes a little bit. For me, fortunately, I've been in a position where a lot of projects have come to me.
And a lot of these characters, or a few of them, including Peggy, they are from time to time on the other side of the law, outlaws. Talk a little bit about that. Criminals, outcasts, outlaws. I know that is appealing from a dramatic point of view, but from an actor's point of view, how do you approach that?
I think there are no bad guys when you're playing them, because they always have a way of looking at the world that's just different than everyone else in society, or different than the way we think they should be looking at things.
When I was watching Peggy, I thought, wow, this is really a classic narcissist. And yet we love her. We're rooting for her. I'm wondering how you approach that and how you try to balance that. So we're not repulsed by these characters, but we see them as intensely flawed. And maybe in real life, we don't want to spend time with them, but we do on TV, at least.
Here's the thing. I never set out to manipulate an audience one way or the other. Like, I need you to, I'm going to make you fall in love with her. I'm going to make you hate this person. I'm just looking at her mechanisms. Like, she is incredibly manipulative. She is a destructive person. She's constantly leaving this chaos in her wake. But like many other addicts, she's smart and funny and sweet and has a good heart. And pretty early on, we learned she's what they call a double winner. So she's been taking care of her mom and her siblings when she was little. So she's also codependent. So she's picking mm-hmm. up all these broken birds along the way. I don't know about you, but I've known some addicts in my life and loved mm-hmm. them very much and lost a lot of them. But yeah. that doesn't mean I can't celebrate all the things they knew about art or fashion or any of these different things.
Right. And so growing up with your dad, you know, struggling with alcoholism, you've talked about that, and also smoking a lot of weed, you've talked about that publicly, and also your mom being abusive, and moving the family to a commune in the South, and that's chaotic,
yeah.
right? And so did you draw on that feeling a little bit on when creating this character? Or
I think that living in the commune was very pivotal. I really got to grow up in nature. I didn't understand money, and I didn't understand the material force and how much money mattered in the world. Everyone was poor, so we were all the same. I didn't understand that there was a real caste system in America until I moved to the city, and I mm-hmm. realized, oh, rich people are better, or they think they're better. But yes, I think I definitely grew up in a chaotic circumstance, and Peggy is chaos, and this world that she is in chaos. And maybe there's a part of that that is my playground.
The other character you're playing right now on TV seems to be the opposite of that. Harmony Cobell in Severance seems to be the opposite of chaos, just very, very controlled and buttoned up.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because I had a therapist say once, a lot of times when kids grow up in chaos, they choose very structured things. So these characters are the opposite, and I played them right back to back from each other. And to play Cobell, who's so structured, interior, conditioned by what everything that she grew up in, to then turn around and play Peggy that's wild and an explosion, was such a joy for me. Also coming out of COVID, we were all coming out of COVID. To be able to laugh every day felt like such an incredible gift. And I feel the world so heavy right now, the more we can laugh, the better.
Yeah. Was there not a lot of laughing on the set of Severance?
It was really hard. I mean, we were shooting that in the full-on pandemic. Our whole crew was wearing shields and masks all the time. So there was no joking around. There was no hanging around the set.
Yeah.
It was only this year that I got to see people I worked with all last year, that I got to see their face.
Wow. That must have really affected you, and I wonder if that made the character colder.
If anything, I think it made me want to break out of the coldness, because I was really missing that connection.
Yeah, yeah. So the second season of Severance is on hold right now because of the writer's strike. Is that correct?
Yeah, I don't really have an update on what is going on, but I do have to say that Severance has always been very confusing and beguiling. There's these mazes, hallways, and they would move the doors overnight, and you'd get trapped in the maze hall and be like, I'm on the set. I'm here for rehearsal. Stay right there. We'll come get you. It's like you're severed every time you're working on Severance.
Yeah. So we don't know when you're going to resume production. We don't know when the writer's strike is going to end. You are political. You've made many political statements and acted politically, raised funds for Haiti, for example, attended the Women's March. As I understand it, you grew up going to protests and marches your parents took you to. Where do you see us now? And what is your political passion now outside of acting?
We've all been political in my family. Yeah, my mom was a civil rights activist, and They were environmental activists. And my dad, you know, would bring us to union picket lines. Well, when I won the Oscar, I talked about women's equal pay and women's equal rights. And I'm horrified that women have lost in many states their right to their reproductive rights over their own bodies. And that LGBT families are being attacked. That trans kids cannot even discuss being trans. They can't find a support system. They can't have therapists help them. That their families have to live in fear all the time. I mean, this is the United States of America, and I'm so sad.
It's personal for you because you had a sister who was trans, Alexis.
Yes, and Alexis was such a blessing in my life. And when my daughter was little, we had a fairy party, and Alexis, you know, painted all the little girls as fairies at the party. This idea that trans people are dangerous in some kind of a way with kids, I really resent, because we all know that by and large, it's not trans people who are committing crimes.
Yeah. Back when you made that speech that you referred to, things were on the front burner when it came to women's rights. And there was a lot of progress, or at least some progress being made in Hollywood and elsewhere.
Well, in 2016, I said to everyone, this is not a joke, this election. Women's rights are on the line. We are going to lose the Supreme Court. We cannot do that. We cannot lose a branch of government. What are you doing? And it's really upsetting to me that people didn't care. We can trace it all right back to that. This is all happening because that was allowed. This descent into hell.
So do you think that people don't care and they're not moved enough to do something, or just the stars were misaligned and they were outmaneuvered?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. People didn't care. There's a subconscious bias about not caring about what's going to happen to women, that women have always taken care of you and you don't really need to take care of them. And looking back on what happened, no, we should have cared about what was going to happen to women. And because we know if it's women, it's also going to be LGBTQ people. It's going to be everybody else. You know, it's going to be minority rights. It's going to be activist rights. It's going to be protesters' rights. It's going to, when you start having a society that quickly starts removing people's rights, they're going to remove everyone's rights who they don't agree with. It's a very slippery slope. And it's unfortunate that people just, they never thought that abortion would become illegal in America. And at 6 weeks, before most women know they're pregnant, you might as well have abortion illegal.
Yeah. And so, when you look at what's happening with the writer's strike, and possibly there might be a SAG strike, do you connect that with what's happening politically in the rest of the country?
I mean, maybe I should. I mean, I think workers' rights in all areas are an issue. But I think this AI conversation is very cutting edge. I was on picket lines with my dad with the videos. And then it became DVDs and then, you know, cable television. But this AI thing, they really will replace everyone. And we're going to end up having really mediocre material, first of all. And a lot of people will be put out of work. And this form of art, as we know it, will be dead.
I mean, it sounds a little bit like Severance.
You know, like
a scene from Seven.
Welcome to Lumen Industries, everyone. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really loved our conversation.
Thank you. Likewise, thank you so much for having me.
That's Patricia Arquette. Her latest project is High Desert, which you can see now. It's streaming now on Apple TV+. Okay, those are the kinds of conversations you get on public radio, in-depth conversations. Those are conversations that you want to just cozy up to the radio or to your phone, wherever you're listening from, and just, I don't know, sit back and hang out and learn something, feel something. This is what public radio does. Steve Chiotakis is joining me now to help us make the case for you to go online at kcrw.com/give and throw us a little bit extra during our summer fundraiser. Hi there.
Maybe a little brandy in the corner, you know, the fire going, and you're because obviously we can't get out of winter. I know. Maybe summer will arrive at some point soon in Southern California. One day. This is the time of need for us. And, you know, we typically don't fundraise in the summer. So that's one of the things that we're talking about right now is why are we here? Why are we asking for your support? Well, things are down a little bit, to be quite honest with you. And we're asking for your support. Kick in maybe a little bit more if you've given in the past to help us get through this slow time, right? Mm-hmm. To help us continue the and by the way, what a wonderful interview with Patricia Arquette. That was really nice. And you get that kind of programming, that type of service that you get on KCRW is yours thanks to your past support and current support of KCRW. So go to kcrw.com/give and help us out. Save our summer, will you?
Save our summer. Do it now. Any amount gets you in, and we will be eternally grateful, like an endless summer.
Indeed.
Steve Chiotakis, thank you.
You bet.
Coming up, a tech columnist tries on Apple's new VR headset, and he has some thoughts. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Apple unveiled its first major new product in roughly a decade.
I believe that augmented reality is a profound technology. So today, I'm excited to announce an entirely new AR platform with a revolutionary new product. Introducing Apple Vision Pro.
That's Apple CEO Tim Cook during the unveiling of Vision Pro yesterday. It's a virtual and augmented reality headset. From the outside, it essentially looks like a pair of fancy ski goggles, and it is not cheap. Each one costs around $3,500. Here to tell us more about it and whether it is worth the price is Brian Chen, personal tech columnist at The New York Times. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
So you tried out this thing. What is it like?
I got mixed feelings. Let's just start with that. The headset, I mean, for one thing, it definitely looks and feels better than other ones on the market from Meta and Sony PlayStation. It's more lightweight. The video quality is higher resolution. But I walked away from the experience wondering, what are people going to do with these things? I was still confused because I didn't really see a killer application that I think would make, you know, mainstream consumers run out and go get one, especially at this price tag. And I was a little bit creeped out by some of the software features, including the FaceTime call.
Okay, so describe that, because I'm imagining you would just play video games on these things or, you know, whatever else you do with these virtual reality headsets.
So the FaceTime calls were really interesting. Let me back up for a second. Apple did talk about video games for the headsets, but they didn't really demonstrate that at all. They didn't show any games that we could play, probably because they haven't been made yet. Instead, they're highlighting how people are going to be communicating with each other, working together through these headsets. And one of the main applications they showed was the ability to do video calls through these headsets. And what's really interesting about doing a video call in the Apple headset is, you know, since there's no camera that's looking directly at your face, the headset's in front of your eyes, of course, it has to first create a model of your face. So it creates something called a persona, which is basically like, I would describe it as like a deep fake video avatar of you.
Wow.
And so when you place a phone call using the headset, the other person on the other side is going to see this animation of you instead of actually you. And it looks very lifelike. It does look real to some extent, but you can tell that it's fake because, you know, the face lacks complexity. Like the face looks uniform overall, the texture, there's no shadows. So then you can kind of tell that it's a digital hologram in some ways, like something you would see in Minority Report. And that to me was kind of creepy.
Yeah, it doesn't. It sounds like a heavy lift. Also, when you consider Google and Google Glass, which was when did that come out? That came out a long time ago and was pretty much universally mocked and reviled. And I think Google is pulling the plug on Google Glass. So where are we in the whole VR ecosystem?
The Google Glass, I think, came roughly a dozen years ago, and they couldn't find a market for it. It was pretty expensive. I think it was roughly $1,000 at the time. And it looked weird. You know, it was the idea of like you would wear this thing outside. It was a single lens that went over your eye and you would see data as you walked around. And that is the concept of mixed reality. You know, it's the idea of having data in front of your eyes as you interact with the real world. A lot of people have tried this. It's not really taken off. For various reasons, they couldn't find a market for it. People didn't want to pay for it. People didn't want to wear headsets. They make you look weird, for one thing. But for another, people couldn't find real reasons to use these things because there's plenty of technology out there that utilizes the applications just as well as a headset. You know, for example, watching a movie, which is shown on by the Apple headset, perfectly fine on a TV, even if it looks different on a headset and very interesting, you know. And that was part of my experience as well. They had me watch Avatar 2 in 3D, which, you know, I thought was entertaining. But again, like, I'm watching a movie by myself. I usually, you know, watch movies with my wife. So what would we do? Have two $3,500 headsets and sit next to each other? I don't think so, you know.
You could hold hands, I guess.
Maybe I could be watching something on a headset while she's watching something on the TV, which does not really feel very social to me, you know.
But I guess Apple is excited about it, or they said they were. $3,500, who is going to try this out?
Well, you know, Apple does say that they're excited about it, but isn't it very telling that none of them, like Tim Cook and the other executives, were not wearing it on stage at all? They never wore it. They never wore it for a photograph. I think that's pretty telling. They know that it looks weird. I think the initial audience is going to be app developers who are trying to figure out new ways to make money. They're going to create new games, new software. They're going to be the earliest adopters. They're looking for a new frontier, you know. Mm-hmm. So those are going to be the first people buying it. I think the second people would probably be the Apple enthusiasts. You know, there's a small group of rabid Apple fans who will buy anything that the company makes, no matter how flawed the concept might be or how questionable the idea is. They'll go out and buy the version one because it's kind of like a collector's item. But beyond that, when it comes to, you know, the examples they showed in the presentation, there's no like particular profession that would benefit from this yet. You know, there's no like office worker that desperately needs to wear a headset while they're crunching spreadsheets or sending emails. These are all hypothetical ideas. I mean, they're introducing it now so that they can get ideas from the app developers. Mm-hmm. They're relying and they're in some ways crowdsourcing to the public and trying to ask app developers to figure out what are the killer applications for this device because they haven't figured it out yet.
I love that they're asking us to put on these headsets after we're just taking our masks off and asking us to put something else on our faces.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. And I also think it's funny that they're pushing this idea of remote work when Apple themselves is not a big fan of remote work.
Yeah.
You know, they were one of the first to push everybody to go back to the office. And now they're trying to offer us a device that they say will bring us to a virtual world to work together. I don't really think it checks out if they don't believe in it either.
If they're not wearing it, we're not wearing it. Brian Chen, personal tech columnist at the New York Times. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I'm talking to you in person, not in virtual reality, to get you to become a member of the very real public radio station known as KCRW. KCRW.com/give. That's where you go. As we have been discussing over the past few days, we are in a budget crunch, and that's for reasons really beyond our control. But what is in our control is to go to you and to ask you to renew your membership, maybe give a little extra on your existing membership if you can. And if you're new, if you haven't ever donated, well, please come on in. The water is warm. KCRW.com/give. That's where you go. And we've got tons of great thank you gifts there at the website. We've got a brand new design tote. We've got hats. We've got t-shirts, we have journals, we have mugs, we have a sweatshirt. It's all very, very cool, and you'll want to sport it this summer, all of that stuff. KCRW.com/give, and also our very special, only during this fundraiser, thank you gift, and that is the limited edition Cherry Glazer and Morning Becomes Matcha double lip balms. So you get two lip balms for a $20 a month donation while supplies last. So get in on it now at KCRW.com/give. That's where you go to become a member, renew your membership, or toss us a little bit extra. We do rely on you. We need you. Please help us out. This is Save Our Summer, a special SOS. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for being a member, and I'll see you tomorrow.